Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. It's one of the most scenic driving destinations in the entire world, right in our own backyard, the Blue Ridge Parkway, milepost 213 to be exact. And once there, you'll find even more than fresh air and stunning mountain vistas. The hills are alive with the sounds of Appalachian music, and they'll be ringing in the air all summer long at the Blue Ridge Music Center. Program director Richard Emmett is here to tell us all about it, and he'll be joined by NPR's own Paul Brown. Paul's Across the Blue Ridge is back and badder than ever, and he'll be bringing it live to the Blue Ridge Music Center stage. Then film scholar Mary Dalton goes behind the scenes with her take on three films with religious themes. They've received high praise and skeptical scorn, but they're pulling in the big bucks either way. And Winston-Salem Theater Alliance shares the story of one mother's struggles with bipolar disorder, their impact on her family, and the sometimes unseemly underbelly of suburban life. Next to Normal is coming up next after the news. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. The Blue Ridge Music Center recently announced its Summer Evening Concert Series schedule, and it's a doozy, with artists spanning all styles and iterations of traditional Appalachian music, including the Carolina Chocolate Drops, Steep Canyon Rangers, Kruger Brothers, Stevie Barr, Slate Mountain Ramblers, Red June, and that's just a small sampling. Really. Weekend concerts will continue practically every Saturday through October at the BRMC's beautiful outdoor amphitheater. This Saturday, May 24th, it's Young Appalachian Musician Day with the White Top Mountain Band at 3 o'clock. And you'll find links to more information on our website at WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. The Blue Ridge Music Center is located on the North Carolina-Virginia border, just south of Galax, Virginia, at mile marker 213 on the beautiful Blue Ridge Parkway. If you've never been, you got to go. It's just about an hour's drive from the Triad area, and as program director Richard Emmett tells it, it's well worth the trip.
One of the great things I think about Blue Ridge Mountain music is that its influence has been so widespread, and a lot of times you find that in urban settings they'll have more of an influence in terms of economic development or innovation. The urban setting will create it and it'll go into the rural settings, but in terms of culture, and particularly the mountain music culture, it's been the reverse. Yeah. The rural setting and the mountain music has influenced the music in the urban settings, and so the Americana and the roots music revival that happened in the 60s and 70s and now again in our times, the rural settings influence the urban settings. So bands like Red June and Steep Canyon Rangers from Asheville and Carolina Chocolate Drops from Durham and other bands have been influenced by this style and taking the traditions and adapting them and carrying them forward to new audiences.
Well, you ran the garage for years, and they're so familiar with new bands as they come and go and develop. Is some of this attraction for the urban bands looking to the rural origins like part of that keeping it real thing? Or what's the draw for them?
I think it's very authentic, and I think it's just it's really unique music, and I think it's pretty intense music in terms of learning to play it. I mean, it's hard to get that style. It's like in a way, it's like a classical music. I think that's also why you see folks like Bela Fleck and Edgar Meyer and Yo-Yo Ma and Joshua Bell. All of those folks are going from a little bit from classical back to some of the roots and traditional styles, whether they be American roots or Asian and European roots, but trying to capture that roots movement and fuse those styles with some of the new. It's just a technically complex and interesting style of music.
Dug so deep that they called it a crime. There might be pleasures I've never tasted, but I ain't wasting no more time. Cause the furnace is burning white hot.
Steep Canyon Rangers, one of the best at doing that in their own vernacular, and these guys are really dedicated to the music.
Steep Canyon Rangers is a great band out of Asheville. They have made a name for themselves even before they hooked up with Steve Martin, winning an Emerging Band of the Year at the International Bluegrass Music Association. But obviously backing up Steve Martin, they've gained some new notoriety. But that is a wonderful band. You spoke about the garage. When they were first starting out in Chapel Hill, before they moved to Asheville, they all went to school in Chapel Hill, and they used to come and play at the garage. And they were pretty good back then, but this is 10, 15 years later, and now they're a pretty exceptional band that's one of the top young bands in the Bluegrass bluegrass world.
What's another one that's on your radar coming up through the Blue Ridge Music Center this year?
Sure. Chatham County Line from Raleigh is a great young band from the urban areas.
Sweet Marie, I can hardly wait. This gas in the tank, tonight's our fate. Let us not part so by the porch's light. Let's go out together into the night. Said a friend Peter had a steady way.
They're matched up with a great young band from the Round Peak area, the Buckstankle Boys. And those kids are mostly legacies. Their families played music, and they're playing it now. And they're doing this old-time and bluegrass fusion kind of thing. And it's going to be a fun night with the Buckstankle Boys and Chatham County Line. Some of the other bands from the region, the Round Peak region, North Carolina-Virginia border, are the New Spring Valley Boys. Again, that's a band name that's been carried on from fathers and grandfathers to these young kids that are playing it, and they're spectacular, so people should be on the lookout for the New Spring Valley Boys. There's also a young fiddler, Kitty Amaral. She's 11. She played a few weeks ago at a festival, and Ricky Skaggs was there, and Mac White from the Whites, and they were fawning over her. This girl is exceptional. She's going to be playing with her band, which veteran musicians called the Stray Cats, that back her up. She'll be up there. There's also young bluegrass guy Adam McPeak. He plays with his band, the Mountain Thunder, which includes his dad, Mike McPeak, from the famous band, the McPeak Brothers. I mean, it's just amazing up there how the traditions and the family legacy of the music are carrying forward. These young kids are taking the music, adapting it, and taking it new directions, but also living with the older traditions and exemplifying those roots music traditions that they've grown up with.
That's an area of fascination for NPR's own Paul Brown as well. One of his lectures will be dealing with families in the bluegrass and old-time tradition. And these kids go into it not kicking and screaming at all. It's just part of their life.
Well, there's a real interest and revival, like I said, in this kind of music, roots and traditional, and particularly the older old-time and bluegrass styles. And not only on the East Coast, but the West Coast, it's really booming. But Paul just got back from teaching some stuff on the West Coast. But Paul and Kenny Roro, who hosts the Blue Ridge Backroads show on WVTF out of Roanoke and is a descendant of Charlie Poole, the well-known banjo player. There's Charlie Poole Festival in Eden. They're going to host some shows that they've put together this year that kind of give the narrative history of the music and how it's developed and where it's going. And so Paul's going to do a couple shows, and it's just going to be exceptional to have him, you know, former host of Across the Blue Ridge here on WFDD, doing that. And Kenny Rohr, we're real excited about those programs. They're going to be kind of like radio shows, a little bit like Across the Blue Ridge was in its time.
Kenny and Paul, for the non-aficionado in this world of music and traditional Appalachian music, you can't think of a better guide to kind of hold your hand through it, because they know it inside and out, and they can always point out, just like a great tour guide, what are the fascinating nuggets that you need to know to fill in the gaps for you?
They are the storytellers that carry forth the tradition, just like a Sheila K. Adams does with the history of the music. And they just give you in little spurts, and then they hear this, you know, let me talk about it for a second, and then you hear it. And then it just puts it into perspectives, allows you to capture and understand why that tradition is important and how it's influenced countless bands and musicians down the road.
It's all about the music. It always comes back to that, and I appreciate that. It's not about them. It's about getting you right back to the music. Across the Blue Ridge, Paul, take us back to before it went to air, and your thoughts along those lines. How did it begin in the first place?
It began at this station after I started working here in early 1987, and I had come from years of collecting music in the mountains of southwestern Virginia and in the Piedmont here in North Carolina. I'd worked at a commercial radio station, WPAQ, in Mount Airy before I came to WFDD, and that station, of course, broadcast a lot of traditional music, bluegrass, old-time, gospel, that sort of thing. And with this music going back to my childhood through my mom's songs that she brought with her from Virginia, songs she'd learned in the 1920s, I just felt that there was a connection for me personally and for probably a lot of other Americans, to traditional music of the Southern Mountains and Piedmont. So I proposed to the station manager at the time, Cleve Callison, that we reflect the portion of our community's life which revolved and centered on music traditions. He was interested. We started the program. And at first it was, I believe, a half-hour program once a week. Eventually it went to an hour. After that, we started live programs out of WFDD's Studio A. We went out into the field and recorded at festivals and public events, and on it went. We had some support from the North Carolina Arts Council. It was a wonderful experience.
I can imagine. One of my closest friends was a bluegrass banjo player as a 12-year-old, 11-year-old in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and we became very good friends. It wasn't necessarily the accepted music back then, by any means. This is in the middle of the disco era. You're a man of the rock and 60s and 70s. Was it ever an awkward choice to be going backwards with your musical taste at a young age, or was it all supported all along?
It was not always supported. That's a really interesting question. My mom got it because she had sung old songs since she was a kid and really was responsible for my becoming interested in the first place. My dad was from the classical music tradition, did not really understand traditional music, and I think became much more appreciative of it as the years went on. But his default position was that European classical music was superior in some way, and I think that's the viewpoint of a lot of people. I played classical piano for years, right alongside traditional banjo and fiddle. So for me, it was all music, and it was all art, and it was all expression, and I tried to play each genre as well as the other. But the signal that you get often from the overriding culture is that the traditional music is out of date or cornpone or just not of the same caliber as some other musics. Nothing could be further from the truth if you really want to know. And you read a little bit of the great folklorist Alan Lomax, and he makes very impassioned arguments for the qualities and the depth and the numerous dimensions of traditional music. I agree with him. But no, it wasn't always accepted. I remember when I was a kid in school, we would sometimes have show and tell and that sort of thing. And around the holiday time, I brought in a recording that I'd been given for Christmas. And it was a record titled Good Old Mountain Dew, Banjo Songs of the Southern Mountains. And I got laughed at. So I kind of hid it away, and I played the banjo, and eventually, the banjo was appreciated by my schoolmates and my friends and all that. But it's kind of a rough road for people who are interested in music traditions sometimes to find acceptance in the general culture. So what you do is you create your own culture. You find your own friends, and those people are out there. There's a big undercurrent now of people interested in traditional music of all sorts.
That's something I think you did so well with Across the Blue Ridge, bringing people into the fold. It can be intimidating for folks not familiar with a particular style of music. They feel like they don't get it. But you had a way of, just having listened to some archived recordings of your show, of bringing people into the fold, holding their hand in a way that was supportive and not talking down to. And then you find this whole world, and it sounds like you're kind of coming back full circle in a sense with this new series.
Probably so. I think, David, that the key to presenting any type of music and creating, generating interest is understanding that nearly any piece of music that's worth listening to has a great story behind it. Usually there's a story of an individual, whether it's a classical composer or the tenor of the times or the life story of a traditional musician who plays the banjo or the story of a great dancer and his or her interactions with a community and a broader culture. There's always a great story out there. Now, maybe I'm talking as a journalist. Every place I look, I'm looking for the story. But I think there is. And that's what allowed me to help generate significant interest in music traditions here at WFDD years ago. I found, to my pleasure and modest surprise, that the key audience for Across the Blue Ridge was, in fact, the NPR news and classical music audience. It wasn't the subculture of people who were already interested. Yeah, we got those folks. They know where to find their music, and they would tune in religiously every Saturday to hear this program. But the bulk of the listenership came from the public radio core audience, and that was exactly what we wanted. The way we did it, I think, was to help people understand that there are real life stories behind all this music and to help present those stories and the people involved.
I'm sure you got lots and lots of letters, feedback from listeners. I'm curious if you could share one or two that was particularly meaningful to you along these lines of someone being introduced to this great tradition through your show.
Sure. I used to get letters from people who would say, I never thought I was interested in this. I always looked down on it, or I just didn't understand it. And now I can't miss a broadcast. One of the most interesting comments I got was from Nat Irvin, who is an African-American scholar who at the time was working at Wake Forest University. He said that he and his son would listen to this program together, and it was a bonding experience for his 12-year-old son and him. And beyond that, he started to understand some of the connections between rural white culture, African-American culture, and the various musics that are intertwined in traditional music in a way that he never had before. That was a really good moment for me to hear from Nat in that context and to realize that the program was reaching out and helping to pull people of disparate walks of life and varied cultures together to understand part of the American story in a way that they hadn't been able to before. That was a great moment.
Well, that gives you an inkling as to the underpinnings of a Paul Brown series of any kind is well thought through. And what you've got presented at the Blue Ridge Music Center, three different areas, but each interconnected. And I guess from the beginning in plotting out this series, what were some of your concerns and how did you plot it out?
The Blue Ridge Music Center contacted me, Richard Emmett, who was in charge of the programming there, and asked if I would collaborate on a series of programs that help to put traditional music of our region in some sort of context and would help to draw more people in from the Blue Ridge Parkway who are traveling the parkway. The Blue Ridge Music Center is looking for new audiences all the time. It wants to increase its audience and its attendance. And it has a mission, which is to interpret culture as the national parks all do. And you know, this is on the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is a national park. So what I'm going to do is host three programs over the course of the season. One will be on the fiddle, dulcimer, and song traditions of southwestern Virginia and northwest North Carolina. That's Saturday, July 19th. The second will present two musical families of our region, people with multi-generational music ties in this area, and that will be August 23rd. Saturday, September 27th, we will have a program titled Collectors and Song Carriers of Southwestern Virginia and Northwest North Carolina. It'll have a focus on people who sing, people who've collected a lot of music in the Southern Mountains and the surrounding area, and how they think about it and how they perform it today.
The common thread through all that is this notion of sharing and shared traditions and fiddle and dulcimer and song traditions of Northwest North Carolina, Southwest Virginia. Why is that region so particularly rich in this music?
I'm not certain that anyone knows specifically why. I've become something of a believer in coincidence and serendipity. I think sometimes groups of people end up in certain communities and places together and they build a culture that is somehow durable. And I really think that that's part of what happened in southwestern Virginia and neighboring northwest North Carolina. I think that some interesting people, some smart people who were excellent musicians, found themselves in the same locale and enjoyed one another's company to a certain extent and brought their various repertoires and in some cases merged them, but in others preserved them, but were appreciated. And that this somehow lasted longer than it did in some other parts of the South. Part of what we're seeing, David, is that folklorists came through the area in the 1930s and 40s in particular and discovered some really wonderful musicians. And that actually, I think, started to feed the process of appreciation a little bit. In other words, it helped to provide some additional fertilizer for a culture that was already there. The Galax Virginia Fiddlers Convention was started up in 1935 by a bunch of guys at the Moose Lodge who just wanted to have a fiddlers convention to raise a little money. Now it's become one of the largest fiddlers conventions in the world and one of the best known. That helped to fuel the fire of enthusiasm in traditional music, just the presence of that fiddlers convention. Then you add in the availability of records and radio starting in the 1920s and beyond, and you have something that helps to feed itself, basically. As far as the fiddle, dulcimer, and song traditions are concerned, there was and still is a great interest in the violin, the country fiddle, in this part of the South. And exactly why that is, I'm not sure, but there is English-derived repertoire, there is some African-derived repertoire on both the fiddle and the banjo, the two main instruments in traditional music of the region. And these repertoires were preserved and they grew. They changed when the guitar came along, and there were also zither-type instruments, including the dulcimer, both the lap dulcimer, which you play with a pick or a quill, or the larger hammered dulcimer, which is more like the Hungarian cymbalum in a way. It's really a European, German, and Hungarian-derived instrument that landed in the American South. Unlike a lot of other areas, the Galax, Virginia region had both a strong fiddle tradition and a dulcimer tradition to go along with the many songs that were sung. And we're fortunate to have in this program on July the 19th, Phyllis and Jim Gaskins from around Galax, Virginia. They will be on the program. Phyllis is a dulcimer player. She's a retired school teacher who became interested in the lap dulcimer and went around and visited with some of the great players of the Galax area, including in particular a gentleman by the name of Raymond Melton. There were others as well. But Phyllis was one of the few people who really took an interest, a deep interest, in the dulcimer tradition of the Galax, Virginia area. And without her interest, I'm not sure that we would know anywhere near as much as we do now about how the instrument was played by the old-timers and what the repertoire was. As for her husband, Jim, he is a fiddle player, and he was interested in the old fiddle styles of artists including Luther Davis, Emmett Lundy, Parley Parsons, Charlie Higgins, names that might not mean anything to the casual observer or listener, but I'll tell you that these were some grand old men of the fiddle tradition of the late 19th century and into the first half of the 20th century and a little bit beyond. In fact, I met Phyllis and Jim while visiting with Luther Davis outside of Galax, Virginia in the early 1980s. He was about 93, 94 years old at the time, and I was learning fiddle tunes from him, and they came in the door, and he had talked about them. So I've known Phyllis and Jim all that time, and this was a great opportunity to bring them into the program and give people a sense of some of the really old fiddle repertoire from before the bluegrass era, before the era of big bands, when you'd just be maybe a fiddle player and a banjo player or two fiddlers. That's all you had. That's all that was around. Maybe a dulcimer player. So this is a good opportunity to do that. And we will also have the Piney Woods Boys from Eastern North Carolina over in Raleigh. And you may think that that's out of the region, but the members of the band, Matt Haney, Jim Collier, and Wayne Martin, have spent a tremendous amount of time in the mountains of Northwest North Carolina, once again with senior musicians, collecting music, hearing stories, just being interested, learning. They're a charming trio. They sing great songs, and their instrumentals are fantastic. My wife, Terry McMurray, and I will also be hosting this program and performing. We see our job on July 19th as one of presenting some of the oldest repertoire out there and also some of the songs in particular that were prevalent and widely sung around Galax, Virginia, and down into Mount Airy, North Carolina. We spent a lot of time with some of these old musicians, and since I love to sing, my mom first started me off in this music with old songs. I have learned quite a number of them. I love them, and we'll present some of those.
You can line, I get cold, honey. You can line, I get cold.
Well, certainly your work preserving the sounds of the past and some of these great musicians who have since passed has not gone unrecognized by folks. Chester McMillan or Wayne Henderson talking with them. They thank you off air many, many times for having gone and captured these great sounds and kept these legacies alive for everybody today.
Well, speaking of Chester, Chester McMillan and his son Nicholas and their band Backstep will be on the program on August 23rd, along with Donald Clifton and the Country Boys. And that program is titled Two Musical Families. The point of this one is to present the sense of family tradition and give visitors to the Blue Ridge Music Center an understanding of how this music is passed along generation by generation. Chester McMillan came out of a musical family. He's a wonderful guitar player. He teaches music. His son Nicholas has taken up the fiddle. He also plays guitar, mandolin, banjo. Nick's grandpa, Dick Freeman, the late Dick Freeman, was a fabulous banjo player and also a very good fiddler. So here we've got a family in which on both sides there are multiple generations of musicians. And Backstep is a great old-time dance band, and I think people will really enjoy hearing them. As for the Country Boys with Donald Clifton, the Clifton family has a very interesting history in the area of music. Verlin Clifton, Donald's cousin, is a mandolin player. He also plays some banjo, but when you can get him to play. But Verlin's a mandolin player who is one of the last of the original, what we call, Round Peak area musicians. He was born and raised in the Round Peak community of Surrey County. Round Peak is a mountain, and that's where he grew up, and there was a very powerful tradition of string band music there. So Verlin was involved with that, of course, and grew up in the music, as did his cousin Donald. Donald went more in the bluegrass vein after starting out with some old-time string bands and has been kind of the head man of his band, the Country Boys, for many, many years. And it's a classic bluegrass-style band. They used to appear at a lot of fiddlers' conventions. Nowadays, they generally play private events, parties, that sort of thing. And they played on the radio a lot. When Verlin and Frank Bodie and I ran the Hometown Opry up in Mount Airy in the Andy Griffith Playhouse there, the Country Boys were frequent performers. We had them on the show very frequently. It's a very powerful, wonderful-sounding bluegrass band based in North Carolina and Virginia. And I think people will really enjoy that. Very likely on that program also, Wes Clifton, who is the grandson of Verlin. So now you've got at least three generations of family playing music in that family. So that's going to be great.
The format of these presentations, is it going to be very similar to Across the Blue Ridge in terms of question and answer back and forth, or how do you envision it?
We probably will have some conversation on stage. We want to make sure we have plenty of music, but I do anticipate that we'll help introduce the audience to not just the music, but how it got here and how it developed and the ways in which people pass traditions forward.
That's such a powerful thing to see and experience. Having spoken with the Snyder Family Band, for example, the love that the children experience with this music, it's not a forced feeding by any means, just a shared experience.
And they love it.
Yeah.
September 27th, Saturday, we have a program titled Collectors and Song Carriers of Southwestern Virginia and Northwest North Carolina. And this will feature a great ballad singer and storyteller, Bobby McMillan of Western North Carolina. We'll have the Stewart Brothers. They are a younger duo from the Western North Carolina area, Travis and Trevor Stewart. And they play banjo, fiddle, guitar. They sing some. And also Bruce Green and Don Petty from the Asheville-Weaverville area of North Carolina. Bruce spent a tremendous amount of time in eastern Kentucky collecting fiddle tunes, then moved to North Carolina and has lived there ever since. He became involved in his local community there and got to know a number of the musicians there, learning from them helping to pass traditions forward. Don Petty is a dulcimer player who plays a lot with Bruce Green, and they are all over the western part of North Carolina playing their music. Don also hosts a traditional music radio show on WCQS Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina.
What are you looking forward to most, Paul?
All of it. This is a really, really exciting opportunity for me.
Yeah.
I just love to get the chance to share enthusiasm for these wonderful stories and music that has a sound all its own. It's straight from the heart. You won't hear it on commercial radio. You will not hear it amongst the top 40 any longer, if you ever did. But when you hear traditional music well performed, it's very difficult not to fall in love with it and to fall in love with the stories of the people who play it and sing it and have cared about it and are bringing it into a new generation.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
You're most welcome.
The cold nights of winter weigh heavy on my mind. I walk down to the river to ease my worried mind, and I can see the reflection of the moon on every ice floe in the bay. And I know that you'll soon be on your way.
That's NPR's own Paul Brown. Paul's also an acclaimed fiddler, banjo player, and music historian. He'll be bringing back his award-winning Across the Blue Ridge live at the Blue Ridge Music Center this summer. The first in his three-part series is Fiddle, Dulcimer, and Song Traditions of Southern Virginia and Northwest North Carolina, featuring Jim and Phyllis Gaskins and the Piney Woods Boys on Saturday night, July 19th at 7. Blue Ridge Music Center Program Director Richard Emmett reminded me that the Music Center is a resource that goes far beyond the music itself.
We've got midday mountain music, so every day you come from noon to 4, we've got local old-time and bluegrass bands playing for free in the breezeway. You can sit down and listen, have some lunch if you bring your own picnic, and enjoy the music. There's also the Roots of American Music Museum exhibit. It's an interactive exhibit that tells the history of the Blue Ridge music, and that is just exceptional, put together by Joe Wilson, who was headed the National Council for Traditional Art. He did a wonderful job. It tells the history of the music from old time to bluegrass. You got Ralph Stanley, you got old blues, old ballad singers, and then some of the families through which this music is carried forth, and then also the instrument makers. The Round Peak area, Blue Ridge Mountains, is rife with music makers, both making music and making instruments.
So if you go, are the makers themselves there, or this is part of the museum exhibit?
Part of the museum exhibit, but the music makers are in that region, and you can go visit them. A lot of them are not far. Wayne Henderson's in Rugby. He always welcomes people into his shop. Okay. Mac Trainum's in Floyd County. He always welcomes people into his shop. And so there's lots of places if you want to take it a step further and go from the Music Center out into the communities and visit Barr's Fiddle Shop, where Stevie Barr, who's on our schedule this year, a great banjo player, bluegrass banjo player, his band, the Master Tones, will be playing. He took over the shop from his dad, Tom Barr, but in that shop in Galax, Virginia, is where the Hillbillies, the first band that was recorded and went up to the White House and played for Calvin Coolidge, and then recorded a bunch of tracks, and they named the style of music hillbilly music after the Hillbillies. That's where they formed in what was a barbershop then, which is Barr's Fiddle Shop now. So there's so much history around the region, just within, a few miles driving area along the parkway and out in the communities, that the center highlights this, but we also encourage people to go out and find other stuff that's really happening right now in the communities.
And of course, all surrounded by beautiful Mother Nature.
Oh, great. Fisher Peak Mountain, on one side it's North Carolina, on the other side it's Virginia. We've got some great trails up there. The Music Center is run by the National Park Service, and the two trails up there is Fisher Peak Loop, which is a 2.5-mile moderate hike, and then there's a small kid-friendly, family-friendly track trail that's about a mile and a half right along the rambles along the edge of the mountain and across the stream, and it's just gorgeous. Great way to spend a day with the family, going for a hike, checking out the museum, checking out some music at the Music Center, and then getting out into the community if you choose to.
Blue Ridge Music Center Program Director Richard Emmett. This Saturday, May 24th, it's Young Appalachian Musician Day with the White Top Mountain Band beginning at 3 o'clock. And their concert series kicks off Saturday night, May 31st at 7 o'clock in the beautiful outdoor amphitheater with outstanding bluegrass and old-time mountain music by Chatham County Line and the Buckstankle Boys. Beginning Memorial Day weekend, the Music Center, located on the North Carolina-Virginia border, just south of Galax, Virginia, at mile marker 213 on the Blue Ridge Parkway, will be open from 10 a.m. to 5 every day. You can enjoy the Roots of American Music exhibit and local midday mountain musician concerts there daily from noon to 4. This summer will also feature NPR's own Paul Brown and his live radio show Across the Blue Ridge. The three-part series begins Saturday night, July 19th, with fiddle, dulcimer, and song traditions, and you'll find links to the complete summer schedule at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and we'll take a short break right now. When we get back, film scholar Mary Dalton takes a look at three recently released films that have religion in common, but in terms of quality, Mary says they couldn't be more different. Behind the scenes with Mary Dalton next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got a Pulitzer Prize-winning rock musical for you on the second half of the show. It's Next to Normal, courtesy of the Winston-Salem Theater Alliance. But first, we go behind the scenes with Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. Today, she'll be taking in three religious-themed films that have been generating some praise and some scorn, but one thing they've got in common, besides the religion part, they're pulling in some big bucks.
I don't know if it's Easter or spring or just a coincidence, but it does seem like there have been a lot of films with religious themes in theaters recently. And there are three of them that couldn't be more different, but they're all bringing in some traffic at the box office. I have to be honest, I didn't much want to see any of them. And one of the reasons is I just don't think religious movies work very well. When you're trying to deal with the metaphysical, film being such a literal medium makes it hard to capture the essence of something. But I think it's important to think about these three films, God is Not Dead, Heaven is for Real, and Noah, and to kind of evaluate them on at least two levels, as films and also as theological conversations. So I kind of thought I would start out in ascending order. Yes, I know that's kind of a bad pun, but I'll start with God is Not Dead. And I have to say that this film really didn't work for me. I felt that it was a movie that closes off conversation instead of sparks conversation. It was fundamentalist and anti-intellectual. And as a film, getting away from the theological components, it has uneven acting, it's unintentionally melodramatic, at least I think it's unintentional, and there's a real awkward integration of storylines.
You don't want to deny your faith. I get it. So the answer is simple, drop the class.
Yeah, but I'm not sure I can do that. I feel like God wants someone to defend him.
Don't be ridiculous.
I don't know, I just keep thinking of that C.S. Lewis line. Only a real risk can test the reality of a belief.
So you're gonna risk our future over your yearbook quote? Josh, why am I here?
That's what I was tempted to say in the theater. Why am I here? The answer, though, is pretty clear. It was to see what all the ruckus was about over the film. I think the movie, God is Not Dead, is overly simplistic, and it's not very inclusive. Heaven is for Real worked a little better for me. It's based on a 2010 best-selling Christian book written by a Nebraska preacher about his son's trip to heaven and back. Fortunately, Greg Kinnear, who must be one of the most appealing actors ever, plays the pastor in the movie.
What about the hospital? How do you feel about that? Does that scare you?
No, that's where the angels sang to me.
The angels sang to you?
Yes.
When?
During the operation, when Mom was in one room talking on the phone, and you were in another room yelling at God.
I have to say I was a little surprised by this film. It was predictable, it's very formulaic, but it's not preachy and it's not too sentimental. The acting's pretty good. I've already said that I think Greg Kinnear's great. The writing is really fitting for the film. There's nothing particularly sentimental, which is a plus, but there's also nothing that is too terribly cliched, which is a bonus. And the most important thing about it is that it encourages conversation. It doesn't sort of assert a particular perspective. It's open for questions. When I heard that Darren Aronofsky was making a film about the biblical character Noah, I really was shocked. And I didn't want to go see the movie particularly. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Darren Aronofsky's. I love Requiem for a Dream and The Wrestler and Black Swan, among others. He's just an amazingly talented filmmaker. But I was reluctant to see this film. And I just simply could not imagine how this filmmaker would decide to do a film with Russell Crowe about Noah. But since he's such a brilliant filmmaker, I decided I would go, and I was really glad that I did.
Our family has been chosen for a great task, to save the innocent.
The innocent?
The animals.
Why are they innocent?
Because they still live as they did in the garden.
Yes. And we need to save enough of them to start again.
But what of us?
I guess we get to start again too, in a new and better world. But first, we have to build.
If you go back and read the story of Noah in the Old Testament, there's not a lot of content there, despite the fact that this turns out to be a surprisingly complex story on screen. It's true, Darren Aronofsky takes some liberties in expanding the story, but if you accept that the Old Testament talks about giants, for example, and put that in the context of viewing the film, or also think about some of the meanings that we might get from the Abraham and Isaac story, you'll see references to these things in the film Noah. But the thing that amazed me about this film is that the essence of it ties together so many different narrative threads in the Old Testament. What Aronofsky does, though, is he puts them in a context that encourages both conversation and deep reflection. Not so surprisingly, this is an ambitious, stunningly rendered film. This is one of the most beautiful films visually in terms of the cinematography and the juxtaposition of images and the production design that I've seen in a long time. One criticism of the film Noah that I think is actually a strength is that it deals with some things that are topical now, too, in terms of thinking about Noah's responsibility as a steward of the earth and linking that to contemporary conversations about climate change. Noah is not a perfect film. It's sprawling and ambitious, and it's not a consistently perfect little gem like some of Aronofsky's other films, but it certainly is a film worth considering. So of these three films that I think of as God, Heaven, and Noah, the one I need to see again is Noah. There's so much more there for me to think about, to process, and I have to say, since I did see the film Noah, I've thought about it an awful lot.
Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. That's a little old segment we like to call Behind the Scenes. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and it's time for one more little intermission before Winston-Salem Theater Alliance returns with their production of Next to Normal, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Next to Normal, with book and lyrics by Brian Yorkey and music by Tom Kitt, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning rock musical. It's about a mom, her struggles with bipolar disorder, and their impact on her family. The musical also explores the sometimes unseemly underbelly of suburban life. To prepare for her role as Diana Goodman, the mother, Winston-Salem Theater Alliance actor Heather Hamby says she's followed the lives of several individuals with bipolar disorder and the psychiatrists who treat them. She's also studied other modern media interpretations of the disorder, including Showtime's award-winning series Homeland. According to Heather and her Theater Alliance colleague Henson Millam, who plays her daughter Natalie, the acting challenges they're facing in Next to Normal are equaled by the play's powerful song repertoire.
I will keep the place off spinning, and the world just keeps on spinning. I think the house is spinning.
This is a very rock and roll styled show, and the music really mirrors Diana's mood swing. So there's some really lush, beautiful, sad ballads, but there are also some really hard, driving, manic rock and roll tunes. So it's a lot of big, belty numbers, no holds barred for 2.5 hours.
I often hear rock singers and wonder how in the heck they can do that night after night without getting nodes in their vocal folds.
Absolutely.
What sorts of things, just from a process standpoint, Heather, what sorts of things do you need to be aware of in order to prevent injury, you know, in this case?
Well, I've been working with a really talented vocal instructor who's based out of Elon University, April Hill. She's amazing. She's really helped me find the right placement for these pieces in my voice so that I'm not just yelling musically, which is, I think, what a lot of belters start out doing, and then they realize you can't get very far doing that. You're not going to have longevity in your career if you keep doing that. She also helps me interpret the songs a lot. You know, where do I need to be really powerful and have that rock and roll sound? And where are the moments that I can kind of relax?
What is Natalie's relationship to her mom, Diana? And how do you all work together or not in the play?
Well, almost Natalie's entire life has been spent with her mom suffering from her bipolar disorder. And she struggles with that throughout the show. And she finds different ways to cope with that. First, she finds this boy and kind of builds a relationship with him. And then she experiments with drugs. And she's trying to find a way to figure out how to cope with her mother going through all these treatments and going from being totally manic and then just being depressed all the time. It's just,
she's dealing with a lot. And, you know, Henson sings a beautiful song I love called Superboy and the Invisible Girl. Natalie's kind of lived in the shadow of her older brother through her entire life. And so she sings this song about how he's always the one that Diana loves and puts on a pedestal, and how she's always ignored. And it's a really beautiful, like, cry for Diana to finally see her. And I love, you know, a moment we have towards the end. We sing this beautiful duet, and Diana just says, you know, we will let go of the past, we'll live with what's real, and maybe I'll see you at last. And I love that line, maybe I'll see you at last, because they both kind of acknowledge that she has been invisible for 16 years.
Let go of what's past, and maybe I'll see you at last. We tried to give you a normal life. I realize now I have no clue what that is.
I don't need a life that's normal. That's way too far away. But something next to normal would be okay. Yes, something next to normal, that's the thing I'd like to try.
I feel like that's something that a lot of teenagers can relate to, and even adults. They can sort of see how they've been living in the shadow of another sibling or someone else in their life and trying to live up to the expectations that parents have for them or other authority figures. I know that's something that I have experienced something with, having a sister, and a lot of other people that I know, trying to live up to the expectations that other people have for you because of your sibling or your friend or another person in your life.
Close enough to normal to get by. We'll get by. We'll get by.
I mean, it's been known to be addressing this issue that Diana, your mom in the play, has this bipolar disorder in a very realistic way. And I'm wondering what sorts of awareness has come about from your all's perspective of the illness and how it impacts people's lives.
You know, well, I think that most people nowadays can relate to mental illness in some way. They have dealt with it personally, or they have a close friend or family member that they've been impacted by who deals with some sort of mental illness. So I feel like a show like Next to Normal brings that to the forefront and takes it from being where everybody has a secret, every single one of us walking around with this secret thing we deal with, to all of a sudden saying, okay, here it is. This is what it looks like. It can be really ugly, but it can also be really beautiful. And, you know, how do we as a collective society deal with this? I think that it's really amazing to be a part of the arts, particularly theater, because we get a very unique ability to start these conversations that, you know, aren't easy to start in your average office or your average, corporation.
That's one thing that the arts is great for, is sparking conversations. How does, collectively, the theater family deal with this? I mean, within the Theater Alliance, what kind of conversations have been sparked?
The really unique challenge, I think, of this show is that there has to be, at the very center of it, an authentic family that has gone through some incredible trauma, who has dealt with some serious issues. But at the heart, they also have some great memories, and they've taken family vacations, and they've had family pets, just like everybody else. So we started really early trying to kind of just connect with one another, and we've had little like family dinners and things like that, where we talk about the play, talk about the show. I don't know that we've as yet had a really serious conversation about the illness itself, which I think is kind of typical, in families, like everybody wants to talk about everything but the actual issue. But I know that over the next 2 weeks, because we've now really got the music pretty solid, we finish our blocking tonight, so it'll be completely up and mobile. And then I think we're going to have the next kind of 2.5 weeks to really dive into some of those deeper issues. So I'm kind of excited to see where the conversations go from here.
Yeah. Winston-Salem Theater Alliance actors Henson Millum, and before her we heard from Theater Alliance actor Heather Hamby. The Pulitzer Prize-winning rock musical Next to Normal comes to Winston-Salem Theater Alliance Friday, May 23rd, where it'll run through June 1st, with evening shows at 8 and Sunday matinees at 2. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org, and be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Andre Wallace. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend and archived episodes at WFDD.org. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And as always, you can drop us a line with questions, comments, and suggestions. That email address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.